You are Locked On Knicks, your daily podcast on the New York Knicks. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Shot blocked. Porzingis with his fourth projection. Courtney Lee for three. Beasley lines up. Ntilikina.
What he does is contagious. He comes in, touches.
Hand across the lane. Baker launches. Jack to Porzingis. Fires up the ball.
Welcome, everybody, to Locked On Knicks, the podcast that's in the 99th percentile of explaining, complaining, and entertaining. I'm your host, James Marcina, a.k.a. Jeff Jersey Shornacek. You may know me as the founder of NBA Injury Report on Twitter, and this is episode 288. That music can mean only one thing, and that's there is breaking news. What's that breaking news, you might ask? I've been in a coma for the past 24 hours, you say? Well, let me be the very first person to tell you that Jeff Hornacek has been fired by the New York Knicks. Ditto, Kurt Rambis. They're both out, and we're going to talk about it with the great Alex Wolf of Posting and Toasting. We're going to discuss whether or not Jeff Hornacek deserved to be fired. You may know what I think about that, but maybe Alex has a different point of view. You never know. We're going to go over reasons why he perhaps deserved to be fired and reasons why he perhaps did not deserve to be fired. Then we're going to talk about potential coaching candidates to replace him. Alex and I are each going to give five candidates and a couple of minutes on why we think they should at least get an interview. A really fun sode on a really interesting day in the history of the Knicks. Join me. Will you? All right, hit it, Marv.
Yes.
Jeff Hornacek is out. He's fired. Alex, I need to know, how upset are you about this news on a scale of 1 to 10?
Do you want the honest answer?
I want the honest answer. Hit him with the truth.
A 0.5? I don't know. I'll give him a little bit of sympathy. A 0.5. 0.5 out of 10.
I'm going to go absolute zero Kelvin scale.
Ouch.
Which I think is like negative 400 something, 200 something. I forget, but he deserved to go, I think.
I would tend to agree. There was no results, right? Like, and that's the first thing that you have to look at. Like, he didn't win a ton of games. You could argue, and some people have argued, you know, the team did look pretty good in the early parts of the season, obviously before Porzingis got hurt. But how much are we really attributing to him for that? And how much was it Porzingis himself and just how, like, transcendent he was?
Yeah, I'd like to stay on that topic for a second. Maybe I'm cutting off some things that you were about to say, but he, you know, people have, you know, a couple of Knicks had at least technically, statistically, career best seasons this year. Like, Courtney Lee averaged, like, 0.5 more points per game. Like, oh my God, career year. Like, Jeff Hornacek unlocked him. But starting at the top with Kristaps, who is obviously the most important person in and around the Knicks. He famously stayed away from the Knicks all offseason, worked out on his own. Lots of outlets reported that, contrary to what we originally believed, Porzingis' skipping of the exit meeting was not just about Phil Jackson, but also about Jeff Hornacek. There are rumors that he told Billy Hernan Gomez to tell KP to stop playing like a, quote, pussy. He comes back. You know, KP, after wearing his workout diaper all summer, working out with that sketchball roid head coach of his. And he's on fire. You know, he's having the best month of his career. And then as, for whatever reason, you know, maybe he gets a little tired, whatever, like he starts kind of slowing down. Maybe the league is starting to figure him out. And from my perspective, this is where coaching should have come in. And we were running the most unimaginative sets for KP possible, running him in these, you know, high post ISOs, like play after play after play, not taking advantage of his three-point shooting, not taking advantage of his mobility and his ability to like run off screens and run around curls and that sort of thing. So from my perspective, I can't give Hornacek any credit for KP, really.
Yeah, and who did those sets remind you of?
I mean, Phil Jackson.
No. Who? What player did those?
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Yeah. No. I mean, it was very Melo-esque.
It was like Carmelo, and it was like he was trying to use Porzingis the same way as Melo, which now makes me wonder, like, how much of Melo's last year was all about him, and some of it might have just been Hornacek being like, "I don't know what to do, so just take it and make something happen." But they were kind of doing the same thing with Porzingis, and Porzingis isn't like. He's much better than Carmelo Anthony at like a myriad of things, but he's definitely not better at posting up on the elbow, jab stepping dudes and creating for himself from that spot with no other help. Like the way to get him involved is, like you said, run him around, get him on the perimeter, get him in a pick and roll, like get him in a pick and pop, get him in literally anything other than just throwing it to him and saying like, figure it out.
And speaking of Carmelo, like, he's a very stubborn dude, famously. He won all these MSG power struggles until he didn't at the end there. But, you know, he went to Oklahoma City this year, and obviously now he's got Westbrook and George, so it's maybe not 100% fair, but a different head coach was able to get him to play a different way. And you maybe can't blame Hornacek too much, but it's not a point in his favor that he wasn't able to get Melo to adjust a little bit.
Yeah, and you know, that might just be a humbling of Melo playing with players that he knows are like unequivocally better than him.
Mm-hmm.
But like, yeah, I think there was a consistent theme with Hornacek, and maybe I'm wrong, but to me it just seemed like players didn't really respect his authority so much.
Yeah.
You know, like whatever he wanted, if it didn't match up with what the players wanted, he had no way of getting them to do it. And, you know, if that's like one player, then okay, maybe that player is just kind of like a diva, but there's been like multiple players where it seemed like Hornacek was telling them like, you need to do this. And they were like, nah, I'm going to keep doing what I want to do. Cause I don't respect you, basically. Like last year, for example, he took Courtney Lee, said, you know what, Courtney, like, you might be better off the bench. And he played him off the bench for one game, and that probably was Courtney Lee's best role last year. And he actually played really well in that game. But then Lee kind of, you know, bitched and moaned after the game a little bit about it, like a veteran would if they were told to go to the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hornacek folded the next game and put him back in the starting lineup.
And he also I'm so glad you brought that up, because I had a list of, you know, questionable player relationship incidents, and I had forgotten about that. But he also posted something on Instagram, like some Dumb and Dumber reference when that happened.
Yep.
Like, called him out, basically. It was a little weird. It didn't make 100% sense. I think Courtney Lee's not necessarily the sharpest guy in the world. Shots fired! But it seemed pretty clear to me that, you know, it was vaguely directed in Hornacek's direction. I mean, the whole Noah thing, we talked about KP and his exit meeting. I don't know how much. I mean, Rose is a space cadet, but he felt like he could just leave the team without telling anyone last year.
Yeah.
You got O'Quinn cursing him out this year, Burke brushing him off at the end of the game and running his own play and not calling a timeout. I mean, the Morris twin, I always forget which one it was.
Markeith was that one.
Markeith, yeah. And Marcus is my, like, farsighted, nearsighted. I can never remember which one is which. But, I mean, you add those all up, and those aren't – those certainly – you maybe can say, like, well, I don't know. This happens to any coach, but it's a lot of things that are at least questionable.
Yeah, and, I don't know if it's just his management style, you know, if maybe he's just, like, too much of a dick. Right. And that's why the players didn't like him. Like, there's, like, being a dick, like, to get your point across, and then there's just, like, being a dick, like, for no apparent reason. And maybe that's his idea of, like, being hard-nosed or whatever, and that doesn't really jive with, you know, players now.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't really put my finger on it, but there was just, yeah, there's always just a sense that the players didn't really like or respect
him. Yeah, I mean,
and that they were sort of playing well in spite of him. You know what I mean? Like, they were playing well to spite him, sort of. Like, like, screw you, man. Like, screw you and your shitty plays and whatever. Like, we're still going to win, and, like, there's nothing you can do about it. And then towards the end, just being like, well, we're still going to play hard because we have pride, like, personal pride. But it's not necessarily for you.
Right. I mean, with so many players in these kind of, like, precarious situations, these call-ups and these end-of-contract guys, I'm less impressed that they didn't seem to quit this year than I might otherwise have been. I mean, I will say, like, that could be one thing in his favor. They did seem to play hard all year, but like you said, there could be lots of external motivation for that. And he, going back to what you said about, like, I'm not sure what it is, I mean, he's never inspired me as a speaker. I'm not looking for him to give, like, a, you know, the president of, you know, an Independence Day speech or whatever about, like, how we need to take back Earth. But he's not, like, super eloquent. He also, if he does seem like he might be this, like, old school Utah Jazz Jerry Sloan, like, I'm a dick type guy. And even if you use that as part of your bag of tricks, like, Holtzman famously, Red Holtzman, you remember him?
Of course.
He famously would, like, be a dick when he thought he needed to be, depending on the player and the situation. Like, he would coddle other players who he thought couldn't take it. That was one of his traits that everyone praised, that he knew how to approach each different player. And if Hornacek, this is me kind of, like, guessing a little bit, but if he's using that sort of tack with everyone, that's going to rub some of the guys the wrong way. And it's not just about them being coddled millennials. It's about human beings being different and reacting to different things.
Yeah, and, you know, it's even like some of the stuff too doesn't even strike you as, like, typical machismo tough guy stuff. Like, the thing where he allegedly told Billy Hernan Gomez to tell Porzingis that he thought he was playing like a pussy is just, like, it's so dumb. It's like middle school. Like, go tell him that I think he's a butt. Like, it's so stupid. Like, what are you doing? This is not how you interact with players, especially not your, like, future cornerstone. Like, if you think he's playing like a pussy, tell him that to his face, and Maybe that would work better, you know? But also tell him how to get better. Like, don't just be like, figure it out, you know what I mean? It always seemed to me like Hornacek's style was just to be like, you should know what you have to do, sort of.
And he said that before this year. He's like, last year I let the guys, they were veterans, so I let them kind of come up with their own defensive schemes. It was like, what?
Yeah, like, you're letting Derrick Rose, the fucking revolving door, like, set his own defense? Like,
it was completely strange. And I mean, not to spend too much time on the pussy thing and say pussy a million times, but it's it's like, it's an action that invalidates itself just by existing, because, like, to have someone else tell someone else to stop being a pussy is to, like, be a pussy yourself. And I do want to say here that I don't agree with that use of that word, because it does use, like, feminine characteristics as inherently bad. So I think that's backwards in its own right. That's, like, you know, a separate issue. But if you're trying to tell someone to, like, be tough, and you can't tell them to be tough to their face, like, what kind of a message is that? It's deranged.
Yeah, exactly. And for what it's worth, I totally agree with your distaste of the use of the phrase, too. I've tried to wean myself off that in recent years because, you know, becoming woke and whatever. But
yes, we are. We are the Wokest Knicks podcast. And look, we all make, I'm not saying, like, if you've said this in your life, you're a terrible person, but we should strive to, you know, improve ourselves as time goes on.
Strive to not turn people, like, an entire subset of people into an insult.
Yeah, that seems pretty non-controversial to me. I want to talk about something that's been bothering me all year. I want to talk about three-pointers. Before we do, though, I just want to remind our listeners that you guys are listening to Locked On Knicks, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one daily sports podcast network in the entire multiverse. Three-pointers. The Knicks this year ranked at the very bottom of the league if not the bottom, you know, I haven't looked at the stats as of this morning, but like bottom like two or three in three-pointers attempted. They were very close to the bottom in number of three-pointers allowed. In your opinion, how much of this falls on Jeff Hornacek, and how much of this would you say is a roster construction issue?
Well, let me just say that I don't believe in cheap points. All right, I only believe in the points that you work for on the block.
Like a man. You
know, blue-collar points like a man, down low. And if you're not getting fouled while you're shooting, it doesn't count. Although the Knicks are terrible at drawing fouls, too, so I guess that doesn't really work. Anyway, so I think it was probably a mixture of both. Like, the personnel was not ideal for shooting three-pointers, I guess, but it was certainly good enough that we shouldn't have been bottom three in the league in three-pointers attempted. Like, you look at, you had Courtney Lee, who had a career year shooting the three. He was over 40%, I know. I don't have the exact number right in front of my face. You had Hardaway, who I think struggled with confidence from three, at especially early in the year, because he couldn't throw it in the ocean for the first like 15 games, and then sort of figured it out and got his percentage back up in like the mid to high 30s by the end of the year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But he can certainly shoot the three. Ntilikina showed various points during the year that he can shoot the three, especially as a spot up shooter. He's not too shabby.
Yeah.
Porzingis obviously can shoot the three. Maybe not quite as well as we all like advertise it in our heads. Like, he's still a career with 36% 3-point shooter, something along those lines.
Yeah. But it was his best year ever. He was right around 40, like 39 all season.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, I just pulled this up so I can see all these these numbers. Courtney Lee shot a shade over 40%. Porzingis did shoot almost 40%. Hardaway shot lower than I thought, 32% from three, which seems off. But
but the thing is, he had these streaks where he went like 0 for 700.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, so it's a little Starksian, and like one game's just the worst ever, and one game's like very good, but you have to believe that
a lot of burden on him to create for himself.
Yeah,
and some of the not best shots in the world.
Historically, he's okay enough from three that he should keep pulling the trigger, even though the results weren't there.
But then also looking down the line here, so Jarrett Jack not very good, obviously. Beasley shot almost 40%. Mm-hmm. Burke shot 36%. Lance Thomas shot 40% from three this year.
Yep.
Wouldn't have guessed that. I haven't looked at this in a little while.
He only took one a game from the corner, basically. So
yeah, 1.7 per game, made 0.7 of 1.7 for 40%.
But still, I mean, you could run a couple more plays to find him in the corner. He was hitting it.
Yeah.
I mean, they had Doug McDermott, and they didn't run nearly enough plays for him to hit three-pointers. He shot way better when he was in Dallas because he was in a better rhythm. They jerked his minutes around constantly.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And also Cornett, who you called up partway through the year, had 35%. So, I mean, you've got like more than a handful of guys shooting around 35% or greater from three, which is like roughly league average.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it was necessarily a personnel thing. I think it was a scheme thing. I think that I don't know what happened to Hornacek. Maybe he was still trying to coach like how Phil Jackson had kind of wanted him to coach, because he ran what seemed like a pretty progressive offense in Phoenix, and I thought we were going to see more of that kind of get unleashed this year, and it never happened. So I don't know if maybe he was just like triangled to death or what the case was, but
And it's, to me, I mean, I had like a whole podcast episode about, you know, Hornacek's comments on why the Knicks led the league basically in long twos and their frequency of long twos, and it was very clear that there were some huge coaching differences between what Hornacek was doing and what the rest of the league was doing. They talked to Moutier, and he said in Denver they had a rule that they could take no more than 15 long mid-range shots a game. Like, and I don't know, maybe they make them run suicides. I don't know like what the punishment was or whatever, but it was like, do not take, you need to sometimes like keep defenses honest and surprise them and shoot some mid-range shots, yes. But it's just been proven over and over and over again that you can't shoot these long mid-range shots at a high enough level, a high enough efficiency, where it makes sense to have more than maybe like 15 a game over like 3-point shots. Like, you don't need to shoot very well from three to have that be a better shot than a long two. And the Knicks had a lot of guys who could shoot that, like, even just okay percentage, like you said, where it was crazy that they, you know, were shooting these many mid-range shots. And Hornacek used this crazy math. He's like, well, if you're shooting 6 for 32, it doesn't make sense. You're like, yeah, because that's 22%. No one shoots that from downtown, you know. So,
and on top of that, too, like, you get the feeling that probably in Denver and probably in a lot of organizations around the league, they take better advantage of the advanced stats available to them. And Hornacek did not strike me as a guy that really gravitated towards that sort of thing. Like, I get the feeling he maybe looked at the box score numbers at the end of the day, but he didn't strike me as a guy that went home and went on the advanced tracking service. It's
like Synergy.
Right, Synergy, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, like, he didn't strike me as a guy that went home and went on Synergy and, you know, started looking at the advanced film of his guys and the you know, exact locations where they're taking and making shots and things of that nature. I think he just sort of thought that things would come out how they would just because, you know, he had faith in them to work out. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, he had faith in the players to figure it out themselves rather than coaching them up on, like, this is where you should be shooting the ball and this is going to give you the best results and give us the best chance to win. You know, instead it was just kind of like, do what you do best and, you know, do what your instincts tell you, which, like, everybody playing pickup basketball shoots mid-range jumpers just because it's convenient. You know, you pull up off the dribble and you just shoot because why not, you know?
And it just seemed like he knew it was a thing he was, like, supposed to be into, so he paid lip service to it, but he didn't seem to have a grasp on it. Like he said, he's like, you know, it really comes down to analytics. And then he used some cockamamie explanation that had nothing to do with analytics about, like, why they were shooting mid-range shots. So I want to soon move on to coaching candidates, but in the last couple minutes we'll spend talking about Jeff, at least on this episode. Do you have any, like, lowlights, any least favorite moments from this year?
From this year?
You don't have to have a black heart like I do, but...
Specifically Jeff-related or just, like, in general?
Like Jeff-related.
I don't know, man. Like, his whole demeanor just kind of always bugged me. I don't know. He seemed to... I mean, I understand that you're supposed to as a coach, but he just never seemed to get, like, mad about all the losing and stuff. He always just kind of, like, shrugged it off. You know, it's just like, well, we lost again. Womp, womp. Like, nothing we could have done about it. And it's like, I don't know. It always kind of rubbed me the wrong way. Like, I kind of want to coach. I understand they have to be professional. And especially with the media, like, you can get fined if you go too off the handle or whatever. But I don't think there would have been anything wrong with, you know, getting at least a little heated, you know? Like, I think that that's one part of sort of the Phil Jackson coaching manual is, you know, use the media to your advantage. And I would think that would have been something he would have learned from Phil, is that if you can – you're allowed to badmouth your guys a little bit to the media, like, by name, if you want to, if they're really sucking it up, you know?
Yeah.
And he never seemed to have that, like, anger in him about, like, when the team really wasn't doing well.
Yeah, he seemed a little bit...
And that always kind of bothered me.
He seemed a little bit like he was on Xanax or something. Like,
yeah, definitely.
And it's another one of these, like, I don't know if, like, hypocrisy might be too strong a term, but one of these, like, do as I say, not as I do things, like, we talked about his use of the P word, but then not even being, you know, adult enough to say that to Kristaps himself. But then you've got, he went on this whole rant about how the Knicks maybe don't have players who hate to lose. He was like, you need players who hate to lose. And then he's not showing that same fire. And like you said, you do have to be a leader, but there can be a fine line that you can walk, and he didn't seem to maybe walk it fine enough.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Before we move on to future coaching candidates, if you could make a devil's advocate case for Jeff Hornacek and why he should have been retained, what might that look like?
I think that your crux of that argument would just be continuity, that you keep a familiar face around and a system that the players are familiar with and things of that nature, and maybe eventually it comes around. You know, and like, if nothing else, if the players did in fact like him, which I'm, as we already discussed, I really am not convinced was the case, But if they did like him, then, you know, you keep that sort of familiarity about the organization, which obviously, like, you know, places like the Spurs, now kind of the Warriors, all the sort of model organizations are built around usually a cornerstone coach first, and then they figure out everything else along the way because everybody gets on the same page, makes integrating new players easier. But I don't know. It's hard to even play the devil's advocate for that because I really don't believe it. that's about the best that I could come up with personally.
I mean, continuity is important, and I do think coaches can get better just like players can, but he's shown enough to me. I mean, I am, you know, trying to keep these sodes closer to 30 minutes, so I'm not going to, like, go into great detail, but there were all these things I listed that I had problems with. Weird explanations of questionable rotation decisions. There was the famous time where he said Frank couldn't start that game when he was starting games because he wouldn't be able to chase Jody Meeks around screens. He stressed how important defense was and gave Frank so little burn. He didn't put out the lineups that were performing the best. The KP, you know, Timmy, Frank lineup was one of their best lineups all season. They hardly got any minutes together while those guys were healthy. His in-game adjustments left a lot to be desired. They were one of the worst third-quarter teams in the league. They ran sloppy sideline out-of-bounds plays and baseline out-of-bounds plays. Coming out of timeouts, they frequently looked confused. He had that one time at the end of a game, I think it was during that stretch where they were losing close games to the Bulls and like the Hawks, where he ran a play, they used their foul to give, and then he ran the same play, and they knew exactly what they were doing, and they snuffed it out, and the Knicks lost. There was just, like, a lot of lack of execution, and Hornacek and Perry even cited they were, like, attention to detail might have been an issue with him. And I think that shows. And, you know, is he the worst basketball coach of all time? Like, no. Like, obviously not, but when you're in the NBA and, like, you're coaching the Knicks, you know, hopefully someday can be one of the premier franchises again. Like, there's not room for someone who, like, gets it right 70% of the time. Like, you've got to be on top of your shit. And
yeah, for sure. And I just... It can't be like players will occasionally take plays off or games off or whatever, but as a coach, you can't take a second off during the game.
Right.
You know, you got to be, like, right there mentally the whole time, like, laser focused on what's going on. And yeah, you're right. Like, especially with rotations, too, he tended to kind of seem to drift. Like, he would leave guys out there for, like, 15 straight minutes and then be chewing them out from the sideline, like, not understanding how a guy who just played 15 straight minutes could not be performing well. You know, it's just kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah. So, all in all, you know, I try to, you know, run this show with some levity. I'm not, like, super happy that a dude got fired necessarily, but I don't think he was the right guy. He's got plenty of money. He's going to be all right. So I'm glad that he's gone, but I wish him well going forward. He didn't seem like a bad guy necessarily. Hopefully he lands on his feet. You guys are listening to Locked On Knicks, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. If you like what you hear, head on over to iTunes and rate us 5 stars. Leave a couple sentences of a review. I'm curious what you guys have to say about the show. Once again, that's Locked On Knicks. Let's talk coaching candidates. Woohoo!
Yay! This is the exciting part.
It is. I want to cover 10 coaching candidates in 10 minutes.
Deal.
Do you think we can do it?
Sounds fun. Lightning round. Lightning.
So, Alex and I are going to go back and forth naming coaches who we think at least deserve interviews and giving a little bit of a spiel on why we think that is the case. Do you want to start?
You know, when we did our little draft, you had first pick, so okay. I feel like it would be courteous of me to let you also go first.
Okay.
Because you felt very strongly about your guy.
All right. I went with Jerry Stackhouse, who I irrationally love, knowing very little about him. But let's talk a little bit about his background. He started as an assistant coach with the Toronto Raptors in the 2015-16 season. Then he became the head coach of their G League affiliate, the stupidly named Raptors 905. And he took them to a G League championship in his first season as the head coach in the 2016-17 season, also taking home G League Coach of the Year honors. This year, he took the Raptors 905 back to the championship game. Lastly, the dude is Jerry Stackhouse. Maybe you've heard of him. He was an excellent player in his own right. You know, just being a good player does not make you a good coach, not even close to it. But I do think it is valuable to have that experience to draw on and to add to your coaching chops. He is really, he's been well received around the league. He has a good reputation in the short amount of time that he's been doing it. But I think Jerry Stackhouse absolutely deserves an interview.
Buzz. All right. All right, so my first candidate, I actually just wrote a really long piece about today on postingandtoasting.com. Mike Miller, who is the head coach of the also stupidly named Westchester Knicks, which is very unoriginal, even though they're our own affiliate. So we're talking about another guy who is the G League Coach of the Year. This year, he was the G League Coach of the Year. Two out of his three seasons since taking over for the franchise down there, or up there, I guess, he has had winning seasons. Unfortunately, he was knocked out by your guy this year, Jerry Stackhouse, to the Raptors 905 in the first, well, the second round of the G League playoffs. They do single elimination, and the Knicks had a bye. But at any rate, he led them to very good defensive numbers, which is a plus, and he did that all with a revolving cast of guys, which is even more impressive. He did a pretty good job with developing guys this year. Trey Burke was obviously kind of his crown jewel, coming in there as the reclamation project and then coming back out as a, you know, kind of a diamond in the rough. Plus he had Cornette, Dotson, et cetera. And yeah, he's my guy. I think he's good to look at, and I think he would be a really good guy for player development, which I think is going to be important in this next step.
You mentioned the poorly named Westchester Knicks. One of my favorite Knicksy things of all time is that they ran a competition for fans to name the Westchester Knicks, and then at the end of it, they were like, "Fuck it, we're just calling them the Westchester Knicks." Didn't use any fan submissions.
And it was either the Westchester Knicks or the Westchester Dicks, so we took the Westchester Knicks.
It was so Knicksy. Okay, on to my next coaching candidate. I'm going with Ettore Messina, Paisan. He's an Italian, and they're all geniuses, just like me. He was born on September 30th, one day after me, so I know this guy's got the goods. But talking about coaching, he is currently an assistant coach with the Spurs under the GOAT, Greg Popovich. But before that, he's one of the most highly decorated international coaches of all time. He is this is all as a head coach, four-time EuroLeague champion, two-time EuroLeague Coach of the Year, four-time Italian League champion, three-time Italian League Best Coach, five-time Russian League champion, four-time Russian League Coach of the Year. He's a little bit older. He's in his early 50s, but that's kind of like a sweet spot for coaches, I think. But he's obviously been around for a little bit, but everywhere he's gone, you know, not in the NBA as a head coach yet, but everywhere he went as a head coach, he found massive success. And, you know, he's learning under one of the greats right now, and I think it would be foolish to not at least give this guy an interview.
Cool. Yeah, he sounds good. I like him as well. I think he's one of those guys, with how many European guys the Knicks have, he could be a good guy to bring on.
Yeah. I didn't even list all of his, like, he won other championships in other leagues.
Yeah.
The dude has just won everywhere. So the one thing that I would maybe be concerned about, like, I haven't heard him speak. I don't know how he might relate to, like, American players, you know, as opposed to, like, European ones or whatever.
Or how he would fare in the New York media. Womp womp.
Yeah, that's
always a consideration.
Yeah. But yeah.
Anyway, all right. So next up, we have the one, the only, notorious JVG, Jeff Van Gundy. So he needs really not much of an introduction for Knicks fans, considering he was the last guy to really coach here coach a successful Knicks program, we'll call it, because they've had one or two successful seasons, like the 2012-13 year. But he was the last guy to bring the Knicks to consistent success. Took them to their last finals trip against the Spurs, which is the closest we've gotten to a championship, you know, short of the mid-90s team against the Rockets. All in all, I think he's a smart dude. He really knows what he's doing. Obviously, he's been out of the game for a little while, which is a little worrisome. And he's been a commentator on ESPN, and he has made some worrisome comments here and there about how the game is transforming. But he's also smart enough to not adjust. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, I heard him make some, like, anti kind of 3-point comments, like, years ago, but I don't know if his thinking has changed. Like, lots of people can think one thing one day and are actually smart and look at the facts and change their mind. So Jeff strikes me as a guy who could change his mind. So,
and Jeff also, last point, for people that are worried, like, oh, he hasn't coached since whenever it was, 2007 or whatever, when he left the Rockets. He did coach the Team USA Pan Am Games team last year, which was essentially just like G Leaguers, and took them to an undefeated record in a championship in those games last year, which is, I believe, Pan American Games. I think it goes all the way from like, does it go to Canada? Either way, it's like mostly like North America and South America are those games, and he took them to a championship. So that's definitely worth something.
There you go. My next pick is the wonderfully named, I might just pick this guy for his name, to be honest, but Nick Nurse. He is someone who I hadn't heard about until today, but Mike Vorkunov over at The Athletic, shouts to you, Mike, had him on his list of potential candidates. He is the Toronto assistant who has been widely credited with really helping to modernize their offense this year. The past couple years, the Raptors have seemed like a team that is kind of topped out at Eastern Conference final type talent. And a large part of that was because one of their best players, DeMar DeRozan, just did not shoot threes. So Nick Nurse has been credited as one of the guys who was a real driving force in getting DeMar DeRozan to shoot threes. He's shooting them well. It's one of the reasons he's, you know, obviously not going to be a serious contender for MVP, but is at least in the conversation. And the Raptors in general went from a team that was very heavy on the mid-range to a team that was very heavy in three-point shooting. This past year, you guys have heard me harp on over and over and over again how I want the Knicks to shoot more threes. So this origin story really speaks to me. Someone who like transformed a franchise that was stuck in old ways, helped bring them to the light. Again, like I haven't heard this guy speak. I don't know his demeanor. I don't know too much about him. But based on the very impressive elevation of Toronto's game this season, when I really thought that they should, you know, maybe blow it up, they were never going to be a championship contender, they've proven me wrong. I think this guy seems like he's had a lot to do with that, and I think he deserves an interview.
Good.
Nick Nurse.
Call the nurse.
The nurse is in. The doc.
I don't know
nurse,
where those go.
Nurse the franchise back to health. There's a lot, you know.
There we go. Yeah. All right. So my next one is a very popular candidate among Knicks Twitter, especially, it seems like. I got Jay Wright, very many people probably already know of as the most recent national championship coach as of a couple weeks ago. He coaches Villanova. He coaches one of at least a couple players that the Knicks should probably look at in this draft in Mikal Bridges. So his success is kind of, it speaks for itself. He's got two national championships in the last 3 years at the college level. He clearly understands how to connect with and develop young players, which would be important for, again, that's probably my number one thing that I want out of a coach is being able to connect and develop these young players, because you've really got like this, these two like perfect pieces of modeling clay with Porzingis and Ntilikina that need the proper tutelage to get to where they need to be. I think he could be a guy that could do that. And then especially if the Knicks somehow do draft Bridges, then if you can bring in his college coach, that's essentially like having two coaches out there, which is another helpful thing. He would be someone who's familiar with what's going on. But yeah, I think he's just, it's hard to argue against him. My biggest concern and why I wouldn't put him like number one on my list is because I don't know why he would leave his situation that he's in right now to come to the Knicks.
I mean, so, if you think that, you know, Perry and Mills are running like for the first time an organization that makes sense, I get the allure of a Knicks job. You've always got like Dolan you got to wonder about to a certain extent, but I mean, that's appealing to be the guy who like turns the Knicks around. I don't necessarily think it has to make you a maniac. Plus, in his favor, I've heard him speak a lot, and he does have a very kind of like magnetic personality. He's charming. I think he'd do well with the New York media. But I think I think he's got a presence. I think people would respect him, his players, you know, most importantly, obviously.
Yeah, and he's from the area, the general area. He was from Bucks County, PA. He grew up there, so he's familiar with the area. His first coaching job, from what I see from his Wikipedia page, was at Rochester University, or University of Rochester, which is Rochester, New York. So he's definitely, he knows the area. I'm sure he's got an appreciation for it. So
okay. I'm going to, my final two candidates are both trailblazers of a sort. The first, I'm not even sure how to say this guy's name, but Igor Kokoskov is what I'm going with. He is currently a Jazz assistant under Quinn Snyder, a very well-respected head coach in his own right. So if you like, you know, coaching candidates that come from a illustrious tree, like if you like a Popovich-style coach, this might be a plus in his column. Most impressively, perhaps, he took Slovenia to gold at Eurobasket this past summer as the head coach, the Doncic whisperer. So he's got some experience with the youth there. In 2000, I said he was a trailblazer. He actually became the first non-American to be hired as a full-time assistant coach in the NBA by the Los Angeles Clippers. He's bounced around a bit. I haven't gotten into too much of like why he's been with like six or seven different NBA teams. But people keep wanting to bring him in. He won gold at Eurobasket this past summer. He must be doing something right. He's someone who intrigues me. I get a little bit turned on, might be strong, but when I when like I hear about players, when I hear about coaching candidates who I haven't heard of before, I'm always just very intrigued by them because I know in any field there are lots of bright minds, there are lots of talents that aren't, you know, super well known for a variety of reasons that aren't related to their skill. And I kind of just have a soft spot for like finding a diamond in a rough, giving someone a chance who may not have gotten a fair shake previously, all that kind of stuff. Like that's a little bit, you know, just Disney World type shit. But I like being able to like, I would love, it would make me feel so confident about the front office if they were to pluck someone out of like relative obscurity and they wound up being a great coach. That's kind of like my pipe dream, I should say.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's totally reasonable. That's kind of the dream, right? To like find the guy before he becomes the guy.
Yes. So Igor Kokoskov. I'm probably saying that wrong, but that's my fourth out of my fifth.
Well, you gave it a try.
Yes.
My fourth will be another maybe familiar name to those who were paying attention the last few years, Josh Longstaff, former assistant coach of the Knicks. He was actually let go by Phil Jackson, like right 2 weeks before Phil was ousted as the president, oddly enough. He assistant coached with the Knicks last year. He developed a really good rapport with Porzingis. Actually, he was part of the Derek Fisher staff as well, now that I think about it. He developed a really good rapport with Porzingis, which is the first thing that I think is a good item on his checklist. You want to have instant rapport with the star player.
Yeah.
So that's good. This year, he got a job coaching the Erie BayHawks, which, as it turns out, that used to be the Knicks expansion team. Yeah. Expansion team. Used to be the Knicks G League team. But this year, they were actually an expansion team because the previous BayHawks got moved down to Orlando to be Orlando's G League team this year. So basically, he led them to a 28-22 record. They made the playoffs. They actually just lost to the Raptors 9-05 as well. So I guess my two coaching candidates suck compared to Jerry Stackhouse. but he just seems like he's kind of got it figured out, and he had success as a head coach this year, which is always a good thing, with an expansion team, no less, which is always impressive.
Yeah.
And lastly, he, while my first candidate was the official, like, voted on G League Coach of the Year this year, Longstaff was named by the blog Two Ways 10 Days, which is like a popular Medium blog about the G League. He was named their Coach of the Year this year. Okay. So that's worth something.
You reminded me of like one quick point in Stackhouse's favor, which I hadn't mentioned earlier, and that's, you know, the Raptors, a lot of people think they have the best bench in the league, and most of those guys have spent time in the G League developing with Stackhouse. So he's got some player development chops.
I got to give myself a quick, like, pat on the back because, I mean, not that I have anything to do with it, but the one kid on the Raptors 905, Malachi Richardson, that they picked up for, like, chump change from Sacramento this year, I used to cover him playing high school basketball all the time, and I was watching him play in that game against the W Knicks, and he was, like, kicking ass, and I think next year he's going to be really freaking good. Oh. Like, they'll probably call him up to the big club next year, and I think he could actually do some stuff.
You heard it here first-ish, probably, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I got the inside tip.
That's right. My final coaching candidate is another trailblazer, as I said. Becky Hammon, the first female assistant coach in a major professional male sport in the United States. She spent the past 4 years learning under the great Greg Popovich. She was a two-time All-WNBA first-teamer and a two-time All-WNBA second-teamer. Like I said before, Stackhouse, it's not everything, but I think it's very good if you can combine coaching skill with someone who, you know, has that kind of like ground-up knowledge of what it takes to succeed in a professional sports league. The one thing you might be able to say is she is relatively new to coaching, although so is Stackhouse. But I could see her needing a bit more seasoning, perhaps, as a coach. But I would just love to see the Knicks give her an interview. I think it can only bring good karma to the franchise. She definitely has some bona fides, which make her a legitimate candidate. It's not just like some charity thing because she's a woman. But it could go a long way toward beginning to wash the stink off of the Knicks from the Isaiah Thomas era and all the bad things they have done with regards to women in and around the organization for getting Dolan's treatment of the Liberty. I mean, you know, it's like an endless laundry list. But that's just kind of icing on the cake. Becky Hammon seems like a really smart basketball mind. I would like to see the Knicks give her an interview.
Also, if she was having like a really awesome hair day, we could call her Becky with the good hair.
Oh my God. You know, would the Post be hip enough to like have that as a headline?
If they have like one 20-something page layout person, they could figure it out.
Something to look forward to in the future. Who's your final pick?
My final is David Fizzy Fizdale. Woo! Take that for data.
I just want to say before, okay, so like, I don't even want to, if you guys have not heard David Fizdale's legendary Take That for Data rant, just stop listening to the podcast right now and come back after you've Googled David Fizdale Take That for Data. It's one of the legendary coaching rants of all time.
Okay. All right, listeners.
Did I steal your thunder?
Okay. No, that's okay. No. I'm talking to the listeners right now. I'm breaking the fourth wall. I said, hey, listeners, are you done? Did you listen? All right. Okay, this is why they should interview Fizdale. When you're talking about good coaching trees, he did serve under Spoelstra in Miami for 8 years, which is a really good program, much they hate to admit it. And Spoelstra is a really good coach, as much as I hate to admit it. He had one and change seasons with Memphis. He was 43-39 in his first year in 16-17. And then this year, he managed to go 7-12 before they fired him, which is a little absurd. All in all, I think he's a type of guy that would coach defense into these guys, which is something that's like sorely needed with this team. Because he came from a place in Memphis, even though he's only there for a little over a year, where that's been kind of their identity for like a decade now. And he came from Miami, who always kind of overachieves and plays up to the strengths of their players, which I think would also be important if the Knicks want to see any sort of success pre-Porzingis coming back next year to maybe put themselves into a situation where they can maybe make the playoffs or something. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just think he's very qualified. I think he deserves another shake in this league, unlike some of the other former coach candidates that I'm not super high on. I think that he's definitely a guy that deserves another shot and was probably not given a fair shake in Memphis.
So, as you guys and gals who are listening have probably noticed, Alex and I are not necessarily fans of what people commonly refer to as the retreads, head coaches who have been around for a while, maybe a couple different stops. The big names that have popped up so far in this category are Monty Williams, David Blatt, Doc Rivers, and Mark Jackson, in addition to the ones that we, you know, mentioned in Jeff Van Gundy and David Fizdale. Of those four that I just mentioned, who we hadn't previously discussed, Alex, is there one that you don't want more than any of the rest?
Mark Jackson, 100%. I don't even have to think about that for more than 1 second, right? You can make like an okay case for any one of those other guys. Monty Williams did okay. The only reason that he left was because of the tragic death of his wife, mm-hmm. which is like terrible. And he's now just saying that he's ready to come back. But he was actually relatively successful with New Orleans, so I wouldn't have a huge problem with him. Doc Rivers, I just think, would have greater expectations than what this team could deliver him, which could cause some problems. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like Doc Rivers is the coaching equivalent of LeBron or whatever, where like he wants to go to a situation where he thinks he can win right. at this point. Mm-hmm.
David Blatt is someone who he's got kind of a Messina resume in that he's won a lot in leagues outside of the U.S., like multiple championships. But the stink of that LeBron thing is very strange. You'd have to really figure out what happened there that he was fired.
Blatt, you could put in the same category as Fizdale, though, where you think that maybe he deserves another shake.
I could totally think that, but it's a big red flag that you need to really seriously investigate and find out what happened there.
But Mark Jackson, are we cool with Kirsten still? Just one?
Yeah, you can drop a tasteful one in there.
Mark Jackson fucking sucks. I don't want him.
Lots of Knicks fans do. Now, we're going to have more in-depth conversations about a lot of these coaches over the coming days, including Mark Jackson. I think I'm going to devote a whole episode to him because so many Knicks fans still think he's great. But give me like the Cliff's Notes of why Mark Jackson sucks.
I don't know. I think he's overrated, like coach acumen-wise, and I won't get too much into that because I'm sure you really want to delve into that another time. But the thing that really rubs me the wrong way is that he's this like, and I mean, look, I don't have a problem with people that are evangelical. Like, I understand the religion's role in society and whatever, but he is pushy evangelical to the point where he like forces his teams to do team prayer sessions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that really rubs me the wrong way. Same. Like, religious freedom is important and he kind of just stomps on it. He did that weird thing where like he took Steph Curry to the church that he's a pastor at. And like, they did like one of those, like, hallelujah, you are healed kind of deals where like he and his wife like threw holy water on his ankle or something and
no, made really?
It like answer. Yeah, it's a real thing. I looked it up. and then I don't know. He just seems like a dick and I don't like him and I don't want him. And there's just,
you talk about dysfunction in the locker room for the Knicks. The stories out of that Golden State locker room were wild, of like assistants secretly filming meetings because they couldn't trust that like people would report back what accurately happened. Like,
oh, and he made Festus Ezeli cry because he like, while Festus Ezeli was like away from the team, he convinced the rest of the team that like Ezeli was rooting for them to fail so that he would look better when he came back or something.
Yes.
Like, oh, that's freaking, like, that's so skeevy.
And we're just, like I said, I have to have a whole episode about him because I need to put this to bed, like, once and for all. It's going to be my hit him up, hopefully, if I do it right. But he just fostered such a strange and horrible work environment, forgetting even, like, some of the basketball stuff. He had some positives, but also a lot of negatives there, too. And he is just not the answer for this Knicks team at all. Agreed.
No, you think Jeff Hornacek pisses people off? Wait till Mark Jackson gets in here.
All right, so we went a little longer than I thought we were gonna, but come on, this is one of the biggest days of the season, for better or worse, for the New York Knicks. I'm very glad that you carved out some time for me, Alex. Thanks again.
I have all the time in the world for you always, James.
Oh, thank you so much. Nothing but love in the Locked On Knicks studio. Alex, tell people where to find you online, because I have trouble sometimes finding your Twitter. I'm like, the real, I swear to God, I'm real, Alex Wolf. What's your Twitter handle?
It's just @TheAlexWolf, AlexWolfe. Make sure you put the E.
There we go.
And you can read me on Posting and Toasting sometimes. Go read my thing about Mike Miller right now, because I'm pretty proud of that one. It's a pretty good piece.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but I guarantee it's fantastic. It's been a busy day for me. I will read it before, well, the sun's already set, but before the sun rises, I will have read it. Thanks again, Alex.
You got it, James. Anytime.
Yeah. Good one, right? It's always fun dancing on someone's grave like a complete asshole. I feel a little bit bad about it, but Jeff's going to be all right, you know? And he wasn't the guy. He wasn't the guy to lead the Knicks and Kristaps Porzingis back to the land of milk and honey where championships flow like milk and honey. Anyway, that's it for us today on Locked On Knicks. Thank you very much for joining us. If you got a moment, I want you to do a couple of things. Rate us on iTunes, 5 stars only. Don't be a monster. Subscribe to the show if you haven't already. Tell your friends about the sensation that is Locked On Knicks. But not just your friends, tell everyone. Are you getting your shoes resold? Get the guy who's resoling your shoes. He's a true New Yorker to listen to Locked On Knicks. Follow us on Twitter @LockedOnKnicks. You can follow me on Twitter @NBAInjuryReport. Be chill to each other. Spay and neuter your pets. If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. Always salt the pasta water. And tune in tomorrow for another episode of Locked On Knicks. Peace!